sure you heard the dog barking on the last tape. That was John Lynn's dog, Moses, who got really excited when he heard about his dog ancestors making it on the ark and went barking off with a smile on his face. We're in Genesis chapter 8, verse 13. By the first day of the first month, Noah's 601st year, the water dried up. Noah then removed the covering from the ark and saw the surface of the ground was dry. And by the 27th day of the second month, the earth was completely dry. And God said to Noah, come out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons and their wives. And it made the comment that from the 600th year, 17th day, second month, to the 601st year, 27th day of the second month, would be 110 biblical days, but the biblical month was a 30-day month, and that would be 354 days, about 10 days or 11 days short of our year. So the difference, by the way, in the calendar of the ancient times was made up by every so many years they would insert a month that they called an intercalary month. And that would keep the solar and the lunar cycles in sync with the seasons. But he's on the ark about a year our time, or a year and 10 days their time, which is a fairly long time to be on a boat or on a big floating box with all the animals in the world. But when the land was dry, God said, come out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons and their wives, bring out every kind of living creature that's with you, the birds, the animals, and all the creatures that move along the ground, so that they can multiply on the earth and be fruitful and increase in number upon it. So Noah came out, together with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives, all the animals and the creatures that move along the ground, and all the birds, everything that moves on the earth, came out of the ark, one kind after another. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. That's a good reason for thinking that, yay, I'm glad there were seven pairs, because if there weren't seven pairs that got on the ark, now granted, some of them probably multiplied in the space of a year, but you can't have too much multiplication inside the space of the ark. If he's going to kill one or two here and there, we'd lose some species. Verse 21, the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, will never cease. Chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. It's intriguing, that's exactly what God had said to Adam. Be fruitful, increase in number, and fill the earth. God says the same thing to Noah, because Noah basically is starting over again, just like Adam did. Verse 2, the fear and dread of you will fall upon all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air, upon every creature that moves along the ground, and upon all fish of the sea. They are given into your hands. Now this is the first time that that animals had inherently the fear of man. Before this, everything ate plants. Noah took plants on the ark for all the animals. Now, after the flood, the nature of the animals is continuing to change. Remember, the curse on the earth, the thorns, the thistles, was thorns and thistles will it bring forth. The devil's influence on the face of the earth has not stopped by a long shot, and things continued to degrade. For example, Cain would have had to have had incest with a sister or a sister's child. Yet by the time we get into the writings of Moses, incest is forbidden. The lifespan, I mean, Adam lived 930 years. Noah lived 950 years. Now an old man is 90. So the influence of the devil and sin continues to pervade the earth. And after the flood and all the stuff that was going on with the Nephilim and the fallen race and whatever, now at this stage after the flood, the fear of man is instinctual to animals. Verse 3, furthermore, everything that lives and moves will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, now I give you everything. Now, the history of what man can and cannot eat is interesting, because it starts out with the garden, and then after the fall, all man ate was plants. Then after the flood, God says, okay, you can eat everything. Then, in the Mosaic Law, he will say, okay, these are the things that you should not eat at all. And then in the time that we live in with the New Testament, God says, okay, I've created all these meats to be eaten with thanksgiving, and what's required on our part is thanksgiving. You want to go out and eat bacon? You're not breaking any law. You just give thanks. Verse 4, but you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal. And from each man, too, I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Verse 6, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man. And that's exactly right. This again points to the need for man to control his own society. We saw from Cain. Cain was not threatened. Cain was not starved. Cain was not beaten as a child. Cain simply was envious, and he wanted, and so he killed his brother Abel. Now God says, you want to control society? If a man kills another man, by man shall his blood be shed. God's not going to send lightning bolts out of heaven to make justice on the face of the earth. If the earth will be as just or not as just as we as believers make it. Verse 7, as for you, be fruitful and increase in number. Multiply on the earth and increase upon it. And God said to Noah and to his sons with him, I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, all the wild animals, all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth. I will establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be cut off by waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant I'm making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the cloud, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all the living creatures of every kind on the earth. So God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all life on earth. So here God sets, and we, all of us have seen rainbows, sets the rainbow and says, this rainbow is going to be the sign of the covenant that I've made with you, Noah, that I will not wipe out all the people on the face of the earth. Now I ought to say something this time about the chronology of the Old Testament as we've developed it so far. What I'd like you to do, if you would, is just get a piece of paper and draw a line on it. Just a straight line across from left to right, and break it into four pieces. And if you'll make the far left side 4,000, and the middle 2,000, and the far right side 0, and the two hash marks, if you, in other words, it go 4,000, 3,000, 2,000 would be the middle, 1,000 would be the starting of the last quarter, and you're just going to make a line and divide it into four pieces. To give you an idea of what we've covered so far, if this is the 4,000 years of the Old Testament, Adam's life was 930 years. Now remember, we're looking at the entire Old Testament in this line. Adam's life is 930 years. He lived practically a quarter of the entire Old Testament, Adam alone. Now the flood was 1,656 years after Adam. 1,656 years after Adam. It's like only 2,300 and some years BC. In fact, it was 2,308, if I remember, or 2306 BC would be the flood. So by the time of Noah and the flood, you're halfway through, or getting up to, not halfway through, but you're getting into the area where you are getting close to halfway through the Old Testament. And that's important, because when you're reading the Old Testament, the chronology becomes meaningful, because it shows you what events occur where in the scheme of things. And so keeping a frame of reference on that is very important. And I trust that we will have some handouts with the class that will have some of the chronological dates. E.W. Bollinger has an appendix that has some of the chronological dates, but there's some errors in that. Really, it takes a blending of different chronologers to come out with an exact chronology, because they didn't have it right, really, especially in the King's period, until not really too long ago, in the late 50s, early 60s, a man named Edwin R. Thiele did a lot of work in the King's period. But back to Genesis, and we'll get into chronology more, but if you'll take a look and do that line and keep up with where we are, that'll help. So that's Genesis, and he does the rainbow. God does the rainbow. In Genesis chapter 9, something else I wanted to point out was, remember now, Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. One of those has to be the Christ line. One of those has to be the one leading to Jesus Christ, the promised seed, the one that everyone is waiting for. Who's that going to be? Verse 24 of Genesis chapter 9, when Noah awoke from his line and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend the territory of Japheth, and may Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his slave." Now, in this phrase, in these verses, verse 26, where Noah says, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem," that phrase will indicate that God will be blessed in Shem. Well, there's not a whole lot that any particular individual can do to be a great blessing to God, but Jesus Christ, that promised seed, will be the great blessing to God. And Genesis chapter 9 certainly indicates, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem," that Jesus Christ would be a Shemite, and of course he was. Of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Jesus Christ did come from the line of Shem. Genesis chapter 10 is called by scholars the Table of Nations, and Genesis chapter 10 outlines the sons and grandsons of Noah and where they settled on the face of the earth. And that's Genesis chapter 10. And Genesis chapter 11, we come to the Tower of Babel. And Genesis chapter 11 starts, "Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there." That'd be pretty obvious that the whole world would have one language, because not too long ago, Noah had gotten off the ark, and of course Noah spoke the same language as his three children and their wives. And so everyone would speak that language. And these people moved eastward, and they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. And they said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." Now, that's an interesting historical fact, that they would bake the bricks, because where they were in the Mesopotamian area, they didn't need to bake the bricks. The sun was hot enough that the sun would cure the bricks. They would bake bricks in this ancient culture when they were in a hurry, and they didn't want to take the time for the sun to dry them. So this indicates that what they were doing here, they were in a hurry to do. They used brick instead of stone, and there was a lot of mud and very little stone, so that made a lot of sense, and tar or bitumen for mortar. By the way, in some of the excavations over in the Mesopotamian area, you can still find mud bricks held together by tar. So they had these mud bricks, they used tar, to hold them together for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. I think there's probably a little more here than meets the eye. When the children of these people said, let's make a name for ourselves, the word name is the same Hebrew word as the word Shem. Now Shem was going to be the Christ line. And I think to some degree these evil people are saying they were rejecting God, obviously. We're going to see that because they were building a tower to the heavens, which we know from historical studies it wasn't a tower that they could reach God and shake hands with God. That's not what they were interested in. It was a tower into the heavens, a very high tower, and it would be used for the worship of the stars and the gods of the heavens that they had in their pagan pantheons. All these pagan gods that they had that were related to the stars and the heavens, and that's what they wanted to do. Well, the great huge tower that would be the central place of their pagan worship. And they wanted to make a Shem. We're going to reject God's Christ, God's way. We're going to make our own. And we don't want to be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Verse 5. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the men were building. Intriguing to me and kind of funny is no matter how high these men made their tower, the Lord had to come down to see it. Verse 6, the Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That's why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. And this was the Tower of Babel. And I'm sure that there were many, many languages at that time, and I know that in the study of ancient languages, there are ancient languages that still have not been deciphered yet. There are ancient languages that died out very early. And I think that some historical work could tie some of those into the start of the multiplicity of languages at the Tower of Babel. Then the last half of chapter 11 goes into Shem and his line, and I'd like to pick up the record in verse 24. Verse 24. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he became the father of Terah. And after he became the father of Terah, Nahor lived 119 years and had other sons and daughters. Now, Terah, remember, is going to be the father of Abraham. Verse 26. After Terah had lived 70 years, he became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. This is the account of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran became the father of Lot. Now, remember that Abraham, when he leaves Ur of the Chaldees, is going to take Lot, his nephew, with him. So this shows that Lot was Abraham's nephew. While his father Terah was still alive, Haran died in Ur of the Chaldees in the land of his birth. Abram and Nahor both married. The name of Abram's wife was Sarah. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. She was the daughter of Haran, the father of both Milcah and Isha. Now Sarah was barren. She had no children. Terah took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Abram, and together they set out from Ur of the Chaldees to go to Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. Terah lived 205 years, and he died in Haran. At this point, it's appropriate for me to take you to the Bible Atlas that we wanted you to have as a text in this class. So if you'll open your Oxford Bible Atlas and go to page 55, it's, if you have a different edition than I do, it's the ancient Near East before the Exodus. This map traces some of the root of Abraham. I cannot stress enough the importance of understanding the geography and the location of the cities in the Bible. We used to joke when I was a kid about home movies. I think in my generation anyway, I'm about 40. The video camera wasn't around very much, and the world's worst boring event was going to somebody's house and watching their home movie. The reason that was so boring, watching somebody else's home movies, is you didn't understand about what was going on in the family. It didn't have a lot of meaning to you. You didn't know the places. And because you didn't know the people and you didn't know the places, it was boring, and this was kind of universally known. Oh boy, watching somebody else's home movies. Hey, what fun. Well, that's kind of what reading the Bible is when you don't understand the places and the people. So getting an anchor on the people is very important. Now, if you're on the map on page 55, you can see the city that's mentioned, Ur of the Chaldees. And that's the city that Abraham's going to go to. And if you follow up that little red line, you'll see that one of the cities he goes through is Haran. He heads up the Euphrates River, then he heads about straight north through the A of Aram and the D of Padan. And he ends up in a city called Haran. Now that is what Genesis chapter 11 is speaking of when it says that they set out from Ur to go to Canaan, but when they came to Haran, they settled there. Now the way to find a city on a map, for example, let's say that the Bible here says that Abraham starts out in Ur. You turn to any old map in the Bible Atlas that you want to, and you stare at it until you find the city. No, that's not how you do it. If you flip back in your Oxford Bible Atlas, if you'll go all the way to the back to page 121, there's something there called the Gezeteer. It's called the Gezeteer. What the Gezeteer has is it has a list of the city or geographical names. So, for example, if you look, the very first one listed is Abana. And the Abana is a river of Damascus in 2 Kings 5:12. And you could find that river on map page 49, map page 69. And you can see it would be at coordinates Z1. If you look all the way down the list to the very last name on the list, you see the city of Acre, which could be mispronounced Acre, but it's Acre. The medieval and European name of Ptolemais, the successor of Acco, which you can see. But Acre, and you go across, run your finger across, and you'll see that if you want to find Acre, it's on page 51. It's the italicized print map, page 51, and its coordinates X2. Many times I will be speaking about these cities. If you don't know where they are, you might want to go ahead and turn the tape off and find the city so you can find the location, because that's extremely important. If you'll find the city, find the location, and be able to follow along where the travels are, it will help you immensely in your understanding of the Bible. And as you study the Bible, you'll have a greater understanding by far if you have a grip on the geography. Well, Abraham is an interesting character. We're going to pick up more about Abraham in Acts chapter 7. We're going to pick up more about Abraham here in Genesis chapter 12 and following in the next tape. And this is the end of this tape.